Welcome, everybody, to the Third and Gold podcast. I'm Tyler James, and I'm joined, as always, by the one and only Eric Hansen. Together, we cover Notre Dame football recruiting and more for blueandgold.com on the On3 network. We are nearing the end of the week, and everything still feels surreal. The College Football Playoff Committee pulled the rug from under Notre Dame and left the Irish out of the playoff field. Notre Dame then opted to sit out bowl season, and Athletic Director Pete Bevacqua has been on a warpath since Sunday. To discuss a strange week in Notre Dame football, we reached out to a guest who's been through his share of strangeness around the program, and that's former Notre Dame offensive lineman Mike Golick Jr., who co-hosts The Echoes, a podcast on the Notre Dame Fighting Irish with Jessica Smetana. Mike, thanks for joining us.
Appreciate you guys having me. And yeah, strange week is definitely the right label, as we're hopefully getting ready to put all of this in the rearview mirror. But man, it was interesting to digest at the time.
Mike, let's start with Sunday. How did you experience and process the college football playoff reveal? Did you have any inclination or belief that this was coming?
I always maintain a healthy level of pessimism over what might happen to the football team that I played for and loved, but it was when Alabama flashed at 9 on the board, I literally either sent the tweet or sent the text of, oh, they're gonna do it. Like, they had decisions to make in my mind on what they were going to incentivize and prioritize. Like, you know, I know the committee doesn't totally work that way, but I do think subconsciously it was in the back of their minds, like, hey, are we really going to say that this head-to-head game between two teams with remarkably similar resumes doesn't matter? And are we really going to take a team from inside the tournament field the way that Alabama was and punish them for the 13th data point in the conference championship games that we know is sort of like the Bermuda Triangle? We're not exactly sure, you know, where wins and results go when they enter conference championship weekend. And so I kind of had all those questions in the back of my mind going into this one. And the committee went and took that route to defy the logic of recent weeks in favor of what could still be a defensible result if we hadn't had, you know, 5 weeks of TV shows telling us otherwise.
Well, Mike, one thing I wanted to ask you, and Brady Quinn has been really outspoken about ESPN's role in this. You work for ESPN. Are you of the opinion that they influenced this outcome?
I am not. Like, again, like you said, I'd spent 6.5 years inside the Worldwide Leader. I was a part of covering college football there. I was a part of, you know, covering the ranking shows there. And I don't know, having gone through that mock process with the selection committee, like seeing how the sausage got made, like when you go through that mock process, you're doing a year that's already happened. Like, they gave us like the 2014 season and had us go through it. And like, man, even then you felt how much everyone in the room cared about getting it right. And I struggle to believe that these people that comprise that committee that have worked in and around athletics in different ways for so long are all of a sudden going to come into this room and begin some weird craven process to warp the sport. So I've never bought into the conspiracy theories there. Now, what we're seeing, and I think the effect of, you know, not even just the television networks, but the conferences themselves in this day and age, and I think it's part of what gave way to Pete Bevacqua feeling the need as Notre Dame's athletic director to kind of go out and start to stump for them, is we have seen lobbying around the sport. Like, the people with microphones and a connection to these conferences, whether it was folks in ACC media on behalf of Miami, obviously what we've seen from Greg Sankey and the SEC over the course of the last year, where after 2024's Alabama team was left out of the playoff, they went on the warpath talking about the way that the College Football Playoff Committee needed to talk about strength of resume and the teams that you play and rewarding that. And so I do think that we have seen that, you know, this has always been a sport where might makes right, but now where you've got more of an invitational than a playoff in the way that we've talked about, you know, based on how it operates, I do think we're seeing that effect of, all right, you know, one of the things Pete Bevacqua said is, you know, we realize we're out here fighting for ourselves. And I think that was very present in how these conferences have been able to use their platforms and the megaphone to go out here and try and make sure that you know, they are giving their team every chance in the court of public opinion. And maybe if that message can, you know, get to any of the committee members and subtly influence there, like, again, I don't buy into the conspiracy, but these are human beings. They read, watch, and hear things around the sport like we all do. And so I think everyone right now, especially in the conferences, are very aware of their messaging and how they feel it goes and tries to give them the best chance of helping their teams.
Mike, do you think this year is a one-off in terms of some of the controversy and the discussions about why what needs to change with this playoff format, or do you think this is something that needs to change and that, you know, we can't allow this to continue to happen? What's your perspective? Do you feel like this is more of a one-off, or this is sort of endemic of the way the system has been set up?
So I likened it the other day to someone, like, when you get rolled up on the field, like someone hits you in the side of the leg, like, you go down and you're scared as hell because everything hurts below there and you're not really sure where the source of it is. And then, you know, you wake up on Sunday and the pain's a little bit more concentrated. All the nerves have stopped firing, you know, the everything's changed up and you're a little more aware of where the pain point is. And I don't know, it seems to me the further away we've gotten from the initial injury, the pain point seems to really be, hey, if the ACC and a lot of these conferences just work out their championship scenarios a little bit better, I do think this is going to get a little bit easier. Like, if the ACC just has Miami playing against Virginia and likely winning in that conference championship, as a lot of people have brought up, then I think the domino effect of Notre Dame getting left out changes. Then you don't have two teams from the group of five in a way that's prompting a lot of people to look sideways at all this. Like, I think you can trace the butterfly effect back to allowing having a system that allows for a 7-5 Duke team to make their way and win the conference championship for the ACC. And so, you know, I know that'll obviously change. Jim Phillips has already mentioned that. And, you know, oh, by the way, I know that memo of understanding came out and was big news for Notre Dame this week. But the other part of that is, going forward, the Power Four conference champions will also automatically make the field no matter what. So in this world going forward, Duke would have been in the college football playoff. There would have been no question about them or James Madison. So that's the other part of this that I think's kind of gone underreported this week, is people have, you know, taken their chance to be mad online about Notre Dame in a lot of ways. And that idea that if they're 12th or above, they'd be automatically in the field. Like, you would have also had a sport where those circumstances allowed for that 7-5 Duke team to be in the college football playoff as well. So I think some of these things are going to work themselves out, but I think a sport that kind of grew too quickly in a lot of areas, conference expansion, playoff expansion, led to these unintended consequences that, hey, you know, these people that are paid to see them didn't, and that's kind of on them in terms of how the sport functions, especially once you did away with divisions. But now we've seen these very prominent examples, and I think that change is going to alleviate a lot of this stuff, to where I'm like, all right, we don't have to yell and scream about totally demonizing the group of five and getting them out of the sport. And even expansion, while I think it's inevitable, doesn't necessarily seem like it's, you know, imperative right now, I think, in the way that a lot of people want to make it.
So, Mike, I could ask you, how do we fix this? And we would be here till next Thursday. So I'm going to narrow it to a very narrow part of this. I think where people are most concerned, and I think probably the first or an important step in fixing it, is perceiving the committee as having integrity. Now, they might and they might not, but a lot of people think there's biases or there's agendas. How do we get to the point where people have trust in the process, even if they disagree with it, have trust in the decision makers, even if they ultimately disagree with the final outcome?
Yeah, and I would say to that, like, you know, again, if you know, from a 30,000 foot view, people aren't totally familiar with the committee process, like, you know, there are conflicts of interest at times in that room based on who they represent, and they're recused from arguments that have to do with those teams in the process. I'm sure you know, obviously you guys know that, but, you know, if anyone listening was unaware of that, like, there are steps taken to try and mitigate what could be perceived as conflicts of interest in the room. But even if you think overall there's biases that play a role in this, like, really, I just think the culprit is, like, everyone's talked about it, the Tuesday reaction shows, like, you either, and I've seen some people say, I want to go further, we just need a camera in the room, we need to hear how they're arguing these points, because whether it was Hunter Yurecek this year, or, you know, Mac Rhodes when we started this year, or any of the CFP committee chairs in the past, like, it's an unenviable task of trying to go and distill down all the arguments in the room from various sides and how you got to this point. And so I guess the two schools of thought are you either need even more transparency so that people can see, hey, these are what they're arguing for, or quite honestly, in my mind, my thought process was less is more here. Like, it's worked for the college basketball committee for years, the way they build the tournament field. And in this case, again, we've all talked about it in varying ways this week, but like, if you make this decision at the end of the year based on the final letter grades for everybody off the resumes, it's a little bit easier to stomach, I think, than sitting out here and boxing yourself in logically every week, having to react. Because again, the charge is we're going to build out this top 25 rankings fresh and new every week. The AP poll doesn't have any bearing on it. Last week's bearing. It's all about what your resume looks like this week. And we saw some logical pretzels that the committee ended up twisting themselves into. And so I think you got to either go one of two ways. And the way I would probably advocate for would be less is more. And just if you need to do one to satisfy the TV deal in the middle of the season, so be it. But then save it till the end when all the resumes are finally in. And I think this becomes a lot more digestible.
Mike, one of Pete Bavakwa's complaints has been aimed at the ACC and how they handled maybe pointing out the differences in the resumes between Miami and Notre Dame and making such a strong case for Miami. I'm curious your perspective of that. Obviously, you can understand where Pete Bavakwa is coming from as a representative for Notre Dame, but yourself as someone's very passionate about Notre Dame too, do you have a problem with how the ACC handled that? Do you think it should have been handled differently?
I think at some points, even I looked up, because I understand, like, everyone's got a job to do. Notre Dame's not a football member there, like, on and on down the list. I have a ton of friends in ACC country, and the relationship's always been kind of weird with Notre Dame, right? There's always kind of been this simmering feeling of, you know, you got one foot in and one foot out. What the hell? This could do a lot to help stabilize the conference if you guys would just go ahead and pull the ripcord and join the party here. And so I do think some of those feelings were a part of this entire ordeal as kind of a venting of frustrations. But it at times seemed like a bit much for someone you still had a working relationship with. Like, at the end of the day, I understand Jim Phillips' perspective completely. We have an obligation to our member to go out and do this. The part that seemed to me to be a bit of a, well, all right, why did we feel the need to do this, was towards the end when you saw the cannon all of a sudden shift its way towards Alabama, towards some of the other teams in the rankings that were near there that they obviously have no affiliation with whatsoever. And I'm sitting here thinking, well, that option was available to you all the time to position it as such here in a way that towards the end, the way that, you know, Miami fans and Notre Dame fans were all kind of united in their belief that both of those teams were better than the Alabama team that they had seen play over the last month. That was where it started to be like, all right, well, that was an option that was on the table the entire time. I understand the head-to-head was the most pressing matter. So I think ultimately when we look back on it, it's probably going to be one of those situations that errs more to the all's fair in love and war side of things that we've seen. Like, the gloves come off when it comes to the college football playoff and a belief, right, wrong, or indifferent, again, that I think people in power see the opportunity to try and go out here and at least, you know, state their claim, stump for their team, to try and, in this beauty pageant, you know, polish their team and their conference as best as possible. And, you know, I think that's part of the reason why Pete Bavakwa felt so compelled here. So ultimately, it felt strange at the time, because this was maybe, to me, during the season, the most pointed vocal lobbying that we have seen in the college football playoff era. And maybe it was felt more because it is the team that's my alma mater and now a team that I cover that was in the crosshairs of this discussion. But it did feel like an, all right, I wonder if this is the paradigm going forward now, where if you do have these Tuesday ranking shows every week, you're also going to have whichever teams are sitting on the bubble every week going out here and putting out propaganda and trying to state their claims and using whatever their media influence is to go and try and affect these results as best they can.
So, Mike, following up on the ACC thing on our message board, I mean, and right away, and then after Pete Bavakwa spoke with the Core Beat media, he was on your show, he was on other shows as well, but there is a growing sentiment that Notre Dame needs to shop around for something better. Now, let's pretend that there's no legal entanglements. would that be a good idea? Do you think that maybe this agreement isn't as strong as it was for Notre Dame's standpoint as it was in 2014?
I think I treat this sort of like the, you know, like trade scenarios in pro sports where it's like, you know, Tarek Skubal and the Tigers, like their president just came out and said, like, no one's untouchable. Like, we'll pick up the phone and listen to anybody. Like, you should always kind of keep your options on the table. And I think if you're Pete Bavakwa in this administration, it's your job to always make sure that as an independent, Notre Dame has the best possible path towards their goals. And however that looks, whatever combination of, you know, maybe partial deals or scheduling deals that you've got with other people, I do think that's always part of the job. But I think in this case, like I said to someone else, like, you know, while Pete talked about the damage done to this relationship, like, I don't think anything happens in the immediacy here. I don't think anything's going to change between now and next year necessarily, but it is that reminder. Again, you're running this race by yourself. And as much as, you know, I know the ACC crowd talks about the hand they lent to Notre Dame during the pandemic, and that's great, but those were, you know, completely different, uncertain times, and hopefully something we're never going to do again. So in the normal world of proceedings going forward, it's every man for themselves. And in this case for Notre Dame, that's quite literally. And so I do think it prompts some soul searching of, all right, we need to make sure that we're modeling internally what it could look like doing a different way. What would it look like? You know, is there another conference that'd be willing to afford us this same scheduling agreement? Would it have to be a full membership case, you know, for someone like the Big Ten who may be less inclined to do so? And so I do think you kind of look at everything on the table right now, but understand at this point, like, hey, Notre Dame still needs inventory in November, and the ACC has been willing to provide that at this point.
Mike, Notre Dame's decision to not play in a bowl game has received some backlash. I'm curious, what was your perspective of Notre Dame choosing to do that? And then also, do you think some of the criticisms of that decision have been fair?
So I think in terms of the criticism, Matt Brown, who writes the Extra Points newsletter, said it best. Like, a lot of this just feels like people recognize the thing that they've loved for a long time or were used to for a long time, and bowl season is kind of dying in ways that are certainly sad, but aren't Notre Dame's fault. Like, we're getting ready to play the last LA Bowl, and I can assure you they didn't cancel that when Notre Dame opted out of the Pop-Tarts Bowl. Like, that had been in the works because the system has changed drastically around the sport. Like, you guys know, like, when I was in college and we had the BCS National Championship, if you weren't one of the two teams that played in that and got left out of that championship event, you got to play in the New Year's Six Bowls. You got to play in the Sugar Bowl, the Rose Bowl. And even as little as, you know, 2-3 years ago, if you got left out of the college football playoff in the four-team version, you were still playing in these bowls that had historical cachet, that presented an opportunity and a big stage and all the things that you'd become accustomed to over years of the system being in place. And it's a little bit different now. So for the guys in the decision this year, like, really, like, I know I'd feel, you know, tired at the end of a season. It's an emotional roller coaster in a lot of ways, you know, covering the sport in ways I'm deeply thankful for. But as a player, I also remember how long these seasons are, how long the off season is, how much time you're there. And then to have that happen at the end, like, people are saying, like, oh yeah, these guys, you know, this is sour grapes. Like, yeah, part of this decision is these guys were pissed. I can't imagine what that was like, having the adults that run this process for weeks tell you that one thing didn't matter until all of a sudden at the end when it did matter. And then an hour later, you got to decide if you're going to go eat the humanoid Pop-Tart. Like, that's a wild headspace to have to put yourself in. And so I don't pretend to have answers for how I would have responded in that scenario. Based on what we've seen, life would have been a lot easier if Notre Dame just took the bowl bid in terms of how it's discussed. But in terms of what was right for this team this year, the thing I kept going back to is, like, as long as those guys' voices were heard, and I went through the process in 2009 when we opted out of the bowl game when we were 6-6. It's a very different comparison. It's a lot more akin to what Kansas State and Iowa State went through this year. But, like, at the end of the day, the process was our leadership council, our veterans, our captains, all those guys got together and, you know, talked about what, and had obviously had feedback from the team and had talked to guys about what they were looking at and made the decision that we weren't going to play in that game. And, you know, much the same way this year, that group of guys got together and I'm sure, you know, were stunned and didn't feel like maybe this bowl game felt like the reward that bowl season's always supposed to be billed at, or at least has been in my lifetime. and made that decision for them right now. You know, I already saw Pete say it's not that Notre Dame is done playing in non-college football playoff bowls from here on out or anything like that. It was this group based on, hey, we know if we take this, a certain amount of these guys are going to opt out. It's not going to be the whole team, all that stuff. Like, I do think all of that cocktail of emotions and calculus went into play on this. And again, as long as their voices were heard, I'm kind of good with whatever the result is on the other side.
Well, my proposal is, if the bowl systems continues to shrink, that they merge some of these. Like, I think the Pop-Tarts bowl should have mayonnaise on them for the loser or the winner, if it's you, because I know you like the mayo.
Hey, listen, you know what? And that's a good reminder. Like, none of this comes from a place of wanting to demonize bowl season. Like, we all love bowl season. It's a ton of fun. I'm still going to the Pop-Tart Bowl to hang out and watch that game. Like, I'm bummed I don't get to watch my team there. It personally affected me. I would have loved to have been on the field after that game with Marcus Freeman eating a transubstantiated Pop-Tart, but that's not in the cards. Like, everyone can still enjoy bowl season. This notion that Notre Dame took its ball and went home or is the reason that bowl season is decaying, I think is grossly overstated in this entire process. And the other thing I don't know, and like Ryan McGee, who I love at ESPN, like one of my favorite people on earth, we had him on the Daily Show I do with Dad the other day, and he talked about, you know, the memories made from bowl season and how much when he talks to guys, they look back on that and, you know, would these guys miss that down the road? And that's the question I don't have the answer to. Like, in a week, even now at the end of the week, did the guys wake up and go, man, it would have been nice to have one more? Or if you're Marcus Freeman and the staff, do you wake up and go, man, it would have been nice to have 15 practices with some of the younger guys on our roster to try and go through and make this happen? And maybe logistically certain things would have prevented that from having the maximum impact that it could have. I don't know the answers to that, but you don't get to answer these questions in the future. You answer them an hour after everything happens on Selection Sunday and go from there. And so, you know, that certainly could be a factor, especially for the guys that maybe unknowingly played their last football game of their lives. But, you know, again, you do also have a lot of other memories from time with those guys to look back on, to where I also don't think it's the most severe deprivation of the experience of the sport that some people have painted it out to be.
You mentioned that the 2009 situation was different. It was, you had a coaching transition there. So my question would be, what did you guys do in December as a team once BK kind of took over? And what could this team do to get some, I mean, is it better just to kind of roll it back, do well in exams, spend time with family and not worry about working out, and then just hit it in January? What do you think?
Yeah, we had a pretty sizable gap in between when that decision happened and when Brian got hired. Quite candidly, we got drunk during that time period. It had been a long year. It had been a couple of years. Like, we had known for the last few weeks that we had not played well enough for our coach to retain his job. Like, it was such a weird scenario. And so we got after it for a little bit. I felt so bad. Like, our strength coaches were the holdovers from Weiss's staff who still had their jobs. And so they had to corral us for a couple of workouts every now and then. But, you know, then Brian Kelly gets the press conference and, you know, it gets the job and rolls into his press conference, and like, I had been at fever the night before, so I'm like, all right, it's finally time to lock it back in a little bit here. But no, I do think the other part of that is, you know, jokes aside, and I think for this team, an interesting thing to like kind of consider and view this is like, these guys get to exhale for a second in a way that they have not in the last 2 years. Right. Like, they played the longest college football season of record last year, more games than anyone had played at this level, going to the championship, and had been white-knuckling it since the Northern Illinois loss. Had to be in playoff mode from then on out. Same way they wound up in this year. And, like, I have a one-year sample size of playing football at a high enough level to take things away, like, and draw points. Like, when we went 12-0, I always tell people, I got a crash course in all of the stuff that you hear, like, the highest level winners talk about in terms of what it takes every day to go do this. And like, at 2012, I always tell people, like, was not the most fun season of my life. I was an anxious mess. It was miserable at points because you're so hell bent on doing the right thing, on winning that 5 minutes in front of your face, on coming into the facility and maxing out whatever you've got to do to go out and give yourself the best chance to win games at that level consistently. And towards the end of Brian Kelly's time through now, these guys have hacked that ability to like go and do that. It's more built into their DNA than it was, but it's still a hard process. And so now for these guys to like, kind of have the chance to go home and be with their families around the holidays in a way that you don't normally get, and to have some time to focus on exams without having this other part hanging over you. Like, you'd still choose that 10 out of 10 times. These guys would much rather be preparing for the college football playoff. But I do think at this juncture, for a team that, for a lot of them, a lot of the core pieces are going to be back next year, to have that moment to kind of exhale and then to be able to come back and reset and begin the work with the core of your roster that's still intact, with the coaching staff, the core of which is still intact, with so much unification around the program. Like, I do think there's benefits to that that might be hard to see, but, you know, knowing again how much you miss during the process of being a college athlete. And again, it's not a woe is me or woe is them thing, but it's just the reality that I think having some of that time back for something that feels comparatively normal in this process could have some hidden benefits for these guys later on.
Mike, maybe taking this situation out of it, what sort of development do you think happens for teams in bowl practices? You mentioned sort of sometimes young guys can get some extra development going into a bowl season. Is that something that is substantial that Notre Dame is missing out on?
Yeah, that was kind of the question I was trying to go back and ask myself during this whole process. Like, I didn't start till my last, you know, year and a half at Notre Dame. And so I was one of the guys, like, in bull practice, it was the three best words when you were a starter were young guy scrimmage. Like, you go out there, the guys, you go through individual, and then it'd be, you know, 9-on-7 or 11-on-11 periods where it's the underclassmen on the roster going there and slugging it out. So, like, that's the part where – and for me, it was a little tougher to see those benefits always, just because I had so many position coaching changes. Like, I think that's what kind of muddies it for me is when you got 4 O-line coaches in 5 years, you're kind of going into every spring having to relearn whatever that guy's technique is. And so the bull development only goes so far if you don't have that continuity. But, like, if you've got the same staff for the most part, and I know Notre Dame's already had some, you know, staff losses at the position coach level, with Max going and taking the job at Michigan State. But, like, if you've got the same position coach that's going to be there in the spring, it does give you a chance to, all right, I'm going to get coached like the starters do this week. Like, during the season, if you're a young guy running show team, you're working off cards. You're running the other team's offense. You're getting ready for Navy's triple option attack, getting down in an opposite hand stance like we used to. So it is your chance to receive some of those coaching points and feedback with maybe a little bit more one-on-one time and care than you're going to get during the year. I'm sure these coaches do their best job to coach everybody up during practice, but, you know, you only got so much bandwidth and time during the season. You're focused on the starters and the guys that are going to play meaningful moments for you. And, you know, for Notre Dame, especially defensively, that's a lot more guys right now than I think it's been traditionally, but it's still those opportunities. So I do think there's value in that. How much is kind of specific to each situation, but you know, there's no doubt, like, in a hyper competitive sport, that's the one area I look at and go, if you've got a legitimate criticism of this, it's, hey, you're a team trying to go and win a national championship. All these programs, coaches, staffs are looking for every possible advantage. And they did just leave 15 practices on the table, which is something that is not insignificant, even if it's also not the most important thing that's ever happened.
Mike, before the show, we were talking about the substantial amount of time that you spend watching offensive line play as a member of the Joe Moore Award subcommittee. Because you have such a wide view of offensive line play across the country, how would you qualify, rate what Notre Dame did on the offensive line in comparison to what you see across the country?
Yeah, I think it's one of those things. Notre Dame the last couple of years has really impressed me with the way that their depth has performed, like, and been pressed into duty. Like, you know, my senior year, my fifth year, we had the same starting five the entire year. Like, it's so rare, but this group hasn't been afforded that luxury in the last couple of years. They've had to have a bunch of guys ready to play. You know, Joe Otting was the latest to kind of step up and make that happen. You know, for Sullivan, for Gerby, they had been in competition in camp. They had both played a bit early in the season. And so when he had to fill in for Billy Shrouth at left guard, there was at least some there, but still, like, you got guys moving around and having to communicate in different ways that, you know, they get better as the season goes along. That's been the fun thing about this Notre Dame team the last couple of seasons, has been watching. Like, they clearly get better as the year goes along. The time, the reps, the continuity, like, you can tell it matters to these guys now. You know, it's a Notre Dame offensive line. You know, it wasn't a Joe Moore Award semifinalist this year in the way that I believe they were last year. And, you know, I think you look around the sport, offensive line play is kind of in an interesting position. Like we talked about this a bit, Aaron Taylor kind of does a State of the Union on some of the Trench Life, you know, Wednesday night shows that we do on the Joe Moore Award YouTube channel. And you can see around the sport, like whether it's, you know, the portal changing the way that these offensive lines are constructed, whether it's the time spent on the field, like it's a overall in the sport, what seems like at times a less, you know, physical version of the offensive line position, or one that's predicated maybe more on, hey, we have to account for so much schematically. You don't see as many groups going out there and imposing their will on opposing defenses. And, you know, I think that's something to kind of monitor going forward. You know, the NFL has talked about an offensive line problem for years, and I don't think we're there overall. There's still a lot of units that do a really good job. But I think for Notre Dame, like once again, an incredibly talent rich unit. Like you saw that, like, my God, like it's hard not to salivate and think about, you know, what could have been if, you know, Charles hadn't gotten injured this offseason, and you've got him and Gerby Lambert to build around as the young pillars on that offensive line. I mean, just physical freak shows, the things those guys are capable of. And so I think that for me is the one of the biggest takeaways is, like, you know, you've got young players on that offensive line that got meaningful experience. You've got a treasure trove of incredibly talented recruits waiting in the wings to try and challenge those guys. And you've got a group that's displayed the ability to get better and better as the season goes along. And so, you know, now if you come back after this offseason and you do have, you know, Charles Jagasaw available, which, like, I mean, you put Charles into the lineup. If you'd have put him in tomorrow, he'd have been the best offensive lineman on the team still, I think. Like, we saw that last year. There just aren't a lot of guys that do what he did last December. It was insane to watch. So I'm for Christmas, I want extended Charles Jagasaw reps during the regular season next year. Because I think that's a first round talent kind of player on that group. But I think it's one where they're going to have a different challenge on their hands, because you're probably going to lose the two best running backs in college football this offseason to the NFL. And, like, they erased problems for them. Like, we saw a lot of big runs from Jeremiah were making guys miss in the backfield, making guys miss the point of attack. Some of that's by design, and some of that was he was covering up, mistakes, physical or otherwise, that happened elsewhere. And so the challenge is going to get more difficult. Notre Dame's backfield is certainly still talented, but you're ultimately dealing with a quarterback that outside of the first couple of weeks, we realize maybe isn't someone we want to run a whole lot, given that he's great. So we're going to, you know, protect our sweet baby CJ Carr at all costs. And I say that complimentary, like, wrap that man in bubble wrap, protect him, keep him back there slinging the pill the way he showed us he can do so well. Like, we don't need him in the designed rushing attack, you know, the way that Riley Leonard was so capable of, you know, even though he's shown us flashes of that. So the challenge won't get easier for this offensive line, but it's a room that's capable of stepping up to it, and I'm excited to see the way they do this year.
Mike, if you ever watch Marcus Freeman's Monday press conferences, we get limited to two questions, and sometimes I'm trying to get three questions in, so I combine one that have nothing to do with each other, and that's what I'm going to do with you, because we've kept you way over. So the first part of it is, when people ask you about Marcus Freeman's future at Notre Dame, what do you say? And then the second part is your own future and present. I want to know everywhere that people can see you, hear you, and maybe even eat a Pop-Tart with you.
Yeah, that's good. God, I am so excited for that. When people ask about Marcus's future in South Bend, my party line's always kind of been, it's, for me, the Ohio State job and the right NFL job scare me in terms of what could actually pull him out of South Bend. Like, we see around the sport, there's very few forces as powerful as your alma mater. Like, we have a lot of guys right now coaching at their alma mater doing incredibly well there. And, you know, fending off outside offers or waving off outside offers in favor of trying to help the place that they bled for. And so Marcus is just also happens to be one of the biggest recruiting juggernauts and talent rich spots in the sport. So who could blame him if Ryan Day at some point moved on or was fired and all of a sudden he took the call to come home? I would never fault him for that. And then, you know, the NFL, it's the highest level of competition the sport has to offer. You don't also don't have to deal with all the recruiting aspect of it. Like, it simplifies the equation in a lot of ways. And so if at some point Marcus, who's going to continue to draw interest from there, you know, found a job that called to him in that way, I'd have a hard time really, you know, I'd be sad. Like, it would certainly be a massive blow for Notre Dame, but I would understand those. For pretty much everything else at this point, like, I think Notre Dame's done a really good job of making this a place that has stepped up to meet the modern game where it's at in a way that, you know, wasn't a guarantee when this all started to change. I wasn't sure how it's going to go. And, you know, Notre Dame, from an infrastructure standpoint, from a financial support standpoint, certainly from Marcus's own compensation, it sounds like, are going to make sure that he is one of the highest paid coaches in college football year after year. And so with all that in mind, I think it kind of eliminates the need or desire to go and, you know, feel like you got to do it elsewhere. You know, what ended up coming up with Brian Kelly, where he felt like LSU gave him a better chance of accomplishing on the high end that Notre Dame had and the ceiling that they'd felt like they'd found. Marcus is making the breakthroughs in recruiting that people hoped would be a part of giving him the job before he had any head coaching experience. And he's gone and shown, between the national championship appearance last year, signing a big class this year, like, he can keep this program here more often than not. So I think that's kind of what I've always felt about him. As far as me, it was a busy fall in a lot of very good ways. Hopefully we'll be back calling games on TNT for the Big 12 next year, the way I did this last year. Me, JB Long, a treasure trove of incredible sideline reporters, and the TNT crew were traveling around the Big 12 all year and got to do that. So anyone who watched or listened to that, we really appreciate it. It was a ton of fun. They are first class all the way. The Echoes Behind Me podcast that I started with Jessica Smetana this fall, covering Notre Dame football, joining, you know, the great group of Notre Dame football podcasts out there. We're happy to be, you know, among their number, and just trying, you know, get in where we fit in with the rest of you guys and the great work that you've already been doing covering this team. We're once a week. We release on Tuesdays, and it's been a ton of fun. Jess is a rock star. She is a, you know, vault of Notre Dame information. She, like me, grew up a rabid fan of this sport. And, you know, while she didn't put pads on, you'd be hard pressed to tell the difference in the passion that both of us have for this team and the way that we approach it. I do Golic and Golic weekdays, Monday through Friday, 3:30 to 5:30 p.m. Eastern on FanDuel Sports Network. And if that's not enough of me yapping for you, Monday nights, me and Dad do pregame radio for Westwood One as they get ready for the radio broadcast of Monday Night Football. That's been a ton of fun. And I am going to the Pop-Tart Bowl still this year. I got the invite to come out there and hang out. So I'm going to go and I will go and accept the bowl bid on behalf of Notre Dame. And I will go, and as many people have told Notre Dame in a derogatory sense, I will go and eat the damn Pop-Tart to satisfy our overlords out there who believe that we have slighted bowl season. So I am extremely appreciative of that. I love zany bowls. Obviously, you mentioned the Mayo Bowl ties before. So to get to go and indulge a little bit in bowl season, I know it's changed a lot. And I know it means different things to different people. But I think this time of year where we embrace some of the truly stupid parts of our sport is what differentiates us from the rest of the sports people go out there and choose. I say stupid in such a complimentary way, like embrace the madness and enjoy it, because at the end of the day, this is what it's all about.
Well, in your awesome long list of content, you did not include you reviewing all kinds of unique candies and treats on your social media, which I enjoyed seeing you do those as well. But we appreciate you spending so much time with us today and sharing your insight, and best of luck moving forward.
No, definitely. Thanks for having me, guys. I appreciate it.
We've been adding so many new subscribers to blueandgold.com that the folks at On3 have allowed us to run another flash sale for those who want to subscribe for the first time. New subscribers get 50% off the first year of a subscription to blueandgold.com. So instead of paying $119.99, you only have to pay $59.99 for the first year. There's a link to our subscription page in the podcast description. You can also find the join button on the blueandgold.com homepage. All right, now it's time for questions. You can submit questions to us on Twitter or the Loose Emoji Board before every podcast. I'm at TJamesND and Eric's at EHansenND. We have some questions on the longer end of things, but I wanted folks to be able to vent a little bit this week, given the circumstances. The first one we have is from TCND543 on the Loose Emoji Board. I really think the issue of people complaining about the weekly rating show being the problem and instead just doing one at the end seems like the wrong answer. That removes all transparency from the process. They can then just pick teams however they want and move on. Having Juracek answer that they moved Alabama up after a win over a 5-7 team exposed it. Do you think doing it just at the end is a better solution? And do you know if there are ADs or folks actively part of school administrations on the basketball committee? That seems like a huge conflict of interest that those whose decisions have direct funding implications are part of the decision.
Okay, let's break these two up. Let's just do the first part of this, sure. Which was the complaining about the show, weekly shows. I don't think getting rid of those is, I think we're kind of treating the symptom rather than the cause. I liked what Mike Golic Jr. had to say about it, at least maybe doing one earlier. Now, I think there's, if they are going to have the weekly shows, to have some reforms about it in terms of maybe what Mike suggested, maybe having a camera in the room so we can see the transparency of what they're arguing about, or, you know, not having so much lobbying by the people that are presenting the show, just give us the their opinions and so forth. But it felt like there was a lot of lobbying there. And then you start to wonder, well, is ESPN influencing it? Now, again, Mike was pretty adamant that he didn't think that there was something untoward going on there, but I think you'd have a hard time convincing a lot of fans. That's all I'll say about that part, and then I'll mention the other part.
I think the thing, like, one, the ranking shows aren't going away because I think they're contractually obligated to do those. But I just don't know what the benefit is. And you probably have a different perspective as a weekly AP voter, but I don't know if it helps you determine the best teams at the end of the season by doing this for 6 weeks at the end of the season leading up to that. I'm not sure what the benefit of that is. Is the reason it's happening because it's a TV show and it brings in ratings, or is it happening because it allows the committee to come to a better end solution? And I'm not sure it's the latter. Now, maybe folks feel differently about that. I just, like, for instance, would Alabama be ranked number 9 if the first time they ranked the teams was at the end of the season? I'm not sure that they would be. So that's why I would be in favor of just ranking them at the end. I don't think it's done for transparency's sake. It's done for those ratings. So that's my perspective on it.
Okay, I'm ready to move on to the other part of it, just so that I know we have a big question queue. And that second part was, do you know if the ADs are folks actively part of school administration on the basketball committee? That seems to be a huge conflict of interest, that those whose decisions have direct funding implications are part of the discussion. The way that the two committees are chosen are a little bit different, and they're also a little bit different in composition. But the basketball committee is, if I'm not mistaken, is all but one is an athletic director. So again, the CFP committee is appointed by a different body. It's a college football playoff board of managers, which is made up of chancellors and presidents from the participating conferences and Notre Dame. And then they have a smaller body that they kind of delegate that to. I don't think that, the presidents are pouring over the names and so forth. And there's supposed to be some rotation. The basketball is more connected to the NCAA people. So I think I answered that. I think he asked about bias, right? I think we all bring some natural bias. I think there's honest bias, and I think there's dishonest bias. For example, there's people on our message board, and not many of them, but there are people that felt like if I didn't vote, or if we, because both of us are Heisman voters, if we didn't vote for Jeremiah Love for Heisman, we weren't doing our job. And I think our job is to be fair. If we think Jeremiah is the best player in the country, we need to vote him that and not be afraid of that vote. If we don't think he is, we need to vote who we do. And I think when I look at, my AP duties, I try to be as fair as I can. And I realize if I have Notre Dame above or below where they are in the actual poll, there's going to be people that want me to defend that, and I'm happy to do that, especially as we get deeper into the season. But am I biased against certain teams? I might. I mean, not that I don't like the teams. Like, I don't say, oh gosh, Kurt Cignetti is not a very nice person. I'm not voting Indiana number one. I did vote Indiana number one. But sometimes maybe you have in the back of your mind, gosh, Indiana's never really been good at football, and I used to cover them. And you're wondering how real it is what you're seeing. Now, they proved it, you know, through the season, but it took me a while to convince me that that was the best team in the country. So to me, that's honest bias. Dishonest bias is, I don't like Kurt Cignetti. I think he's a butthole, and I'm not going to vote for them number one.
Yeah, obviously, like you mentioned the basketball committees, like the college ball playoff committee is not the first to have active athletic directors influencing the process. For instance, I looked up, like, the men's basketball committee has Minnesota AD Mark Coyle and Alabama AD Greg Byrne on their tournament committee currently. I'm not sure what the benefit or need to have active ADs on committees is. You're not going to eliminate bias, right? Because everyone's going to have a connection to something. Like, you're not going to be interested in college basketball or college football if you didn't have some sort of rooting interest or tie to a school at some point in your life, right? Like, you can't eliminate that. But it does seem like it makes the job harder for people who are literally getting paid as part of the results of what are happening in those rooms. So I think it would be in the best interest of those committees to not have active athletic directors on them or active conference commissioners on them, because they obviously are influenced. And even if it's not, they're being recused from certain conversations, I think there's still the perception that some of those biases can't really be overcome. And I think it's just asking for people to question you more by including those people in the process. All right, next question is from Irish Cowboy 22 on the loose emoji board. Longtime listener, each podcast, first time caller, sort of. I think the committee is corrupt and will always choose an SEC or ACC, their ESPN broadcast partners, over Big 12, Big 10, or Notre Dame. Can this be fixed? Sure, Notre Dame has a clause next year that if they're in the top 12, they automatically get in, but the committee can just slot them at 13 on purpose to avoid that. My solution is as follows. Remove the top 5 auto bids. Top 12 or 16 teams get in regardless of conference championship. Make a clause that if a group of 5 team gets in the top 15 or 20, if we are at 16 teams, then they automatically get in. Have each conference championship's tiebreakers be number 1 head-to-head and then number 2 based off the committee rankings.
I think there's a lot of good ideas in there. I think it would take us about a week to unpack all those and debate all those. One thing I'm going to pull out of that and say that is an interesting concept to me is there a way to have a check and balance on the committee if we do not think they have integrity, if we can't solve this integrity issue some other way? And it could be just a perception of integrity. When it's hard for me to get past it when I saw Hunter Yurashek talking about how impressive it was for a Alabama team to go for 4th and 2 against a 5 and 7 Auburn team. And that was such a great accomplishment. And then moving Alabama ahead of Notre Dame. I still can't get that out of my head. So what could be maybe a check and balance, maybe computer rankings that a team has to be within maybe one spot of the computer rankings. Maybe it's, although, you know, a conglomerate of computers. If you do just one, like Penn State was a top 20 team in the Sagarin ratings, and they had Notre Dame number 2. But maybe the AP poll is the check and balance. You couldn't do the coaches poll, but maybe the AP, and the AP has its flaws. But there are 66 of us. And so usually if there's one or two knuckleheads, the sheer volume of people voting kind of mitigate those knucklehead opinions. And so I think these are all really good ideas. Everything that you mentioned are good talking points to talk about this offseason.
Yeah, I think it's hard to find a solution. The way that TV rights are sort of woven into the process and the power brokers of this makes it difficult. But like, for instance, the Big Ten's main deal is with Fox, but the Big Ten still has a lot of power in this process too. Like, it's going to be hard to get rid of automatic qualifiers because the Big Ten and SEC really want them. And they basically are the decision makers in a lot of this moving forward. They have the power and they're going to get what they want. So if there was a way to sort of extricate the TV folks from the situation, maybe that helps eliminate some of the bias. Obviously we talked about the committee ties and how maybe you can eliminate bias there. I guess the biggest thing for me is I don't like that we're continuing to change the playoff format. Like, I think you need a bigger body of results to find out if the format is flawed versus the committee being flawed. I would rather tweak the committee than tweak the format personally. I know that's probably not what's going to happen. We're going to keep getting bigger and everyone's going to keep arguing about, well, we're the 19th team now we think the playoff should be bigger. Like, I don't think that's the right answer. Truly, I think we're going to get into worse and worse situations, making seasons longer and devaluing the regular season even more and more. So I worry that we're just keep growing and growing for the sake of appeasing people rather than maybe actually solving what maybe is the bigger issue. And it's the people that are choosing the teams rather than the format of the playoff itself. All right. LDL Go Iris on the Loose Emojis board says, is the memorandum of agreement that Notre Dame gets into the college football playoff if ranked in the top 12 a binding MOA? Some MOAs are binding legally and some are not. If the ACC collapses after 2030, year buyouts reduced, what are ND options for all sports? Is Pete Bavakwa working on those options now? And is there ever a chance that the college football playoff would play on multiple stations, similarly to the NFL with rotating the championship game as the Super Bowl rotates? This would reduce the monopoly ESPN has and the bias to the SEC and the ACC as their partners. Pete Bavakwa has a TV background and maybe could pull this off.
Okay, let's break this up into digestible bites too, just because I can't even remember the beginning of the question, but I have it in front of me. So if the ACC collapses after the 2030, what are ND's options for all sport? Is Pete Bavakwa working on those options now? I'm not sure why he picks out 2030, the year the buyouts are reduced, I guess. The grant and rights agreement is through 2036. I think whether there's buyouts reduced or it's the end of the grant and rights, I think Pete Bavakwa is looking at other alternatives and looking at all other alternatives that could be had sooner than 2030. And I think it's his job as an athletic director to do that. And we talked about that a little bit with Mike Golic Jr., that you need to be constantly assessing and reassessing what's best for Notre Dame. The ACC has changed a lot since Notre Dame signed that agreement in 2014. College football's changed a lot. You know, there's more teams in it now. Stanford is part of it. Stanford was an annual game. They've gone out and done a deal separate from the ACC agreement with Clemson. So, I think it's up to them to make sure that, and I know that he is looking at those things.
Yeah, the first part was the legality of the MOA. I don't know the legality of the agreement that has been mentioned, but it must be pretty certain if Pete Bavakwa is mentioning it and openly talking about it. It's something that I believe we've been aware of being part of future playoff agreements, depending on the format. It's just
right.
So the solidifying of the future format has just not happened yet, and so I think this is always been sort of baked in what is coming next in the college football playoff. In terms of Notre Dame's options if the ACC collapses, I'm skeptical that the Big Ten or the SEC would take Notre Dame on as a part-time member. I think that may be difficult. Like Notre Dame's leverage, the fewer power conferences there are, the less leverage that Notre Dame has. Now they can try to leverage the Big Ten and SEC against each other, but I'm not sure how that would go. It's obviously part of Pavakwa's job to work diligently to maintain that independence while also having a backup plan of some sort.
When this deal was originally forged, and I had a very good source tell me this, that the SEC was a little bit miffed, not in a petty way, but in just a, hey, I wish you had talked to us because we would have liked a chance to match this or at least discuss it. That doesn't mean the SEC around 2014 was ready to do that, but they would have liked to have those discussions. Now in 2025, 2026, is that still the same, you know, because the SEC is a lot bigger now, you know, and do they really need Notre Dame if they're not coming with everything? I think the SEC would love to have Notre Dame with everything, with football and all the sports, but I'm not sure that they would take the partial now. But it's the one good thing, and Pete Bavakwa mentioned it, and I think it was intentional, that there is a very, very good relationship between SEC Commissioner Greg Sankey and Pete Bavakwa. And so I wouldn't rule it out, but I don't think it's likely. But, you know, again, in 2014, it was something that they had some interest in at least talking about.
And then the last question in this series from LDL was, is there ever a chance the college ball playoff would play on multiple stations similar to the NFL?
I think they do in the first round, don't they? Don't they have it on TNT or TBS?
Yes, but it's not – the TNT will never, ever have the more meaningful games. It'll only have a couple of first-round games.
Right.
I think, as I understand it, ESPN actually owns those games but has sold the rights to those games to TNT. So ESPN is deciding whether or not someone can have the other games that they already have the rights to, I think is how it works. I could be wrong there, but I'm pretty sure that it's something that ESPN – a deal that ESPN has essentially negotiated, not the playoff has negotiated with the TNT folks and Turner.
I would not rule out. I don't know that that's going to be the solution, that it's going to get the bias out of this or the perceived bias out of it. But I mean, the way that TV rights and streaming and everything is evolving, I mean, this is a way different world than what we had 10 years ago. So, you know, I never thought Big Ten games would be on Fox and NBC. So I wouldn't rule out that this would look different down the road at some point.
Yeah, I think it's just the length of the contract and the sort of the power that ESPN wields is the hard part of, like, how do you convince ESPN or to give up some of the power it already has, or the money that it is making off of this process, which is probably why we'll never see the ranking show go away either. Next question is from Baby Billy Freeman at Mike EB95. If the weekly CFP rankings did not exist and final rankings were released only on Selection Sunday, do you believe Notre Dame would have been selected over Alabama?
No. Nope.
I do. I think there's a chance that would have happened, because if you just look at the full slate and not just worry about, well, we had Alabama at this last week, we can't drop them two spots because they lost in the championship game, I think all told, Alabama's resume is weaker and therefore would have been ranked lower.
I don't know. I don't want to debate that. I'll leave you with your opinion and I'll stick with mine. But that's an interesting thing that we don't agree on that one. I thought you would think the same thing. Chappie's, but you may be smarter than me. You were smarter about the committee screwing them. So
I don't know if I'm smarter, but I did see into the future, I guess, a little bit there. Chappie 72 on the Loose Emoji board said, everyone that I've seen in media discuss is Jeremiah Love in terms of heading to the NFL, and I'm not naive. I understand why. Yet when asked directly about this on Mike Golick Jr.'s show and other media outlets, the man himself responded that he's not sure if this was his last season. Golick Jr. even pressed him with a follow-up, and he confirmed that he has not made a decision yet. I'm not holding out hope that he comes back, but I also can't see any benefit to him answering that way if his mind was already made up. Is this really a foregone conclusion?
The way that I'll answer it is, I think he wants to do it at an appropriate time. I don't think that there's anybody that thinks Jeremiah Love has more games in a Notre Dame uniform. But, you know, I think during the season, they really wanted to focus on the season and do their best on that and not have that be a distraction. I remember in 2015, Will Fuller was asked before senior day if he was coming back, and he was a junior, and he goes, yeah, I'm coming back. And then that was huge news, and it was kind of a distraction. Then he ends up going pro. I think with a lot of the players, they do want to get evaluations from the NFL. Jeremiah Love has all the information he needs. And again, I think out of respect to his teammates and the Heisman Trophy process and everything else, he wants to do things at an appropriate time and announce it then. He could be still contemplating it, but I would really doubt that.
Yeah, I don't think he wants the focus to be on him. He wants the focus to be on his team. I think he doesn't have to have made a decision. Like, he could declare for the NFL on the final day, and it wouldn't hurt his draft stock in any way.
Which is January 14th.
So I think he can be honest in that he hasn't made his decision yet, but that doesn't mean the decision won't be the one that we all believe is going to be made. So I think that's just my perspective on it. I'm not sure what else to say about it. Next question is from Marie Biafore at Biafore_Marie. Besides the obvious of Jeremiah Love and Jadarian Price going to the NFL, who else do you think is likely to go to the NFL? And which players do you think are on the fence? Of those that are on the fence, could each of you give your opinion on whether you think they should stay or go?
Well, as opposed to Jeremiah, I do think the other guys haven't given it a ton of thought yet because they haven't gotten the feedback. You know, Jeremiah's draft equity is pretty clear, and I would say Jadarian Price's is as well. But I think a lot of them want to do their exit interviews with Marcus. Hey, what does 2026 look like if I come back? And also, they want to get feedback from the NFL. There's an extra layer to this that didn't exist 5 years ago, and that's what would the financial package be of coming back? And that makes the decision, I think, even more difficult. To go, there would be some people that you would say, wow, it's a no-brainer that they would go. And coming back to Notre Dame for another year might make more sense. And as Tyler mentioned, there's not a prize for declaring, you know, there's not incentive to declare any earlier than January 14th. So you have a lot of time to kind of talk that over with your family and think about it. Now getting into names, I think the guys that'll have the most difficult decisions would be Emil Wagner, Billy Shrout, Jason Anye, who's contemplating coming back for a sixth year and applying for that, which isn't a given. Drake Bowen, Jalen Sneed, Josh Burnham, Adon Shuler, and Christian Gray, all for different reasons. I think Wagner probably is the one I would expect out of that group to go that I'd be most likely. Sneed, I'm not sure what. Like Sneed and Burnham could go to other programs, for example. I'm not sure. I know Jason, having spoken to him directly, he would love to come back for a sixth year and get better. He feels like he has more to give to this team and more to give to his future and so forth. Again, if there wasn't a financial piece here, I could see Shuler and Shrout coming out, but there is.
Yeah, I think it's I agree that I think Wagner's the one that I would put closest to the likely situation, but I don't think any of the others are like close to being likely necessarily. Yeah, I think they're all on the fence with Drake Bowen and Billy Shrout and Adam Schuler, Boubacar Traore, even. I don't think that you mentioned his name. Christian Gray. I think personally, I think they all should probably stay. I don't know that any of them have complete NFL draft resumes for very different reasons for all of them. I'm not sure that they'd be fully maximizing their draft capabilities by going this year, but I don't fault a guy for leaving either. So I don't like to tell a guy what to do. But that's just my perspective on whether or not they would be leaving at the the time where their value would be the highest.
Yeah, and I should have mentioned Terrari, but I'm pretty confident he is coming back. That's what I had heard, and so that's why I didn't include him, but probably should have anyways.
All right, TCND says, what are the bowl practice alternatives for the team to get equivalent preparation for next year in?
You know, I asked somebody at Notre Dame, and they weren't sure. I looked it up in two different places, and one says that they can practice without going to a bowl game. One site said they couldn't. There is an NCAA rule in the books. I'm just not sure that it's active, that teams can do some kinds of workouts in December. But I don't think Notre Dame is going to do many of them, if at all. I think they will do lifting and conditioning and things like that. But I think what Mike Golic Jr. Said is a good point. They played the longest season in college football history last year. They haven't had breaks, and probably taking a break and then getting after it in January would serve them best.
Yeah, I spent more time than I'd like to looking through the Division I manual.
You get conflicting answers?
I didn't get conflicting. I couldn't find anything in the manual that said that they could practice. I couldn't find it. That doesn't mean it doesn't exist, but I couldn't find like the section and anything that I think the things that were put on our board were AI results, and they didn't cite where they came up with their information. So I couldn't verify whether or not that was listed in the manual or not. So
right, this one said bylaw 17.10.1.1/17.11 is where I'm getting it.
Okay. And I don't know what that bylaw is offhand at all. But there did seem to be like one, you could do a practice for like tryouts. But I think my guess is whatever is or could happen would be more individually organized than team organized. And I think if you have a strong leader, like someone like CJ Carr, I think he could easily organize team activities that aren't Notre Dame organized. But I don't think anything is necessarily going to compare to the practices that Notre Dame would have had in terms of getting ready for a bowl.
Yeah, I spent way too much time on it too. Not that the answer isn't valuable, but it was frustrating not having
answer. Yeah, I just want to, like, it should be pretty like laid out in a way that is easy to understand, but it was not from my perspective. And sounds like yours either. At Enforcers 2117, could Notre Dame have opted out of the Pop-Tarts Bowl and went to the Holiday Bowl or another bowl game that wasn't going to be on an ESPN broadcast? I believe Holiday Bowl is on Fox and Sun Bowl is on CBS. It would have been nice to see the younger guys get the extra 15 practice and play.
Their reason for opting out wasn't ESPN. I'm sure that they're happy that they're not helping ESPN, but that's not what the player leadership said. They felt like whatever bowl that they were in, whether it's on CBS or ESPN or another network, that this wasn't going to be representative of the team that they put on the field and that there would just be too many opt-outs. And so I don't think that that was something that they wanted to explore. I had heard a rumor that BYU and Notre Dame were going to play in their own game somewhere else, and I did not give that any play because I just didn't feel like that was real.
Yeah, it's always been an assumption that the TV network played a role in Notre Dame not wanting to do that. I'm not. Do you know this, Eric? Do they vote on whether or not they go to a bowl every year? Is it open to a vote often, or is it just like these extenuating circumstances?
I think it's extenuating circumstances. And if you go all the way back to the Pete Chivarelli years when they broke their self-imposed bowl ban in the late 60s, going into 70, they voted then and so forth. But in this era, let's just say the modern era in the 2000s, I think it's only extenuating circumstances. It's not, let's not go play in the Orange Bowl.
Yeah, I mean, I think like there could be folks from Notre Dame who, whether it's Pete Pavakwa, or Marcus Freeman, that said, you know what, why do we want to play for ESPN? Let's ask the players what they want to do, and then maybe we don't have to worry about playing for ESPN. But that, at least it hasn't been the expressed opinion of having any role in what Notre Dame's decision is.
Yeah, and I think at some point they got to, I mean, you have to get a better, I mean, you have to work on that relationship with ESPN and ABC, because you're going to have a lot of opportunities to play away games on that network. You probably want to be, have a better relationship going into, you know, next season.
All right, Mike, at Mike DeVoy one says, once we got shafted by the playoff committee, I was concerned about who would be playing in the Pop-Tarts Bowl. My thinking was several players would sit out in preparation for the NFL draft or to more fully heal, particularly on offense, specifically Fields, Pauling, Stroud, Wagner, Raritan, Love, and Price might sit out. If that happened, CJ might be running for his life all game and potentially get injured, or Blake Hebert gets the start since it's a meaningless game and gets mauled. Do you think that factored into the team's decision to skip the bowl, or am I reading more into it than was there?
As far as the mauling and, you know, that pragmatic side of it, they weren't thinking about that. Again, it was really drilled down to, this isn't representative. This isn't what we want our legacy to be. This isn't representative of the team that we were during the season. And they were really absolutely crystal clear on that part. So they didn't drill down to, now, again, you were going to be missing a lot of pieces, and that's why it wasn't going to be representative. But to say we're worried about CJ Carr getting hurt or Blake Hebert starting, you know, that's just kind of a consequence of that. It's not what drove their decision.
Yeah, and you and I have mentioned this before. For as much as Notre Dame is getting poked fun at for sitting out the bowl, if they went to a bowl game with a diluted version of its team and got beat, they would be made fun even more for saying, see, you should never belong in the college ball playoff to begin with. And so,
like Florida State did a couple of years ago.
So I think that plays a role in the whole perspective on it too. Baby Billy Freeman at Mike EB 95. Do you believe the timing pressure to accept / decline a bowl bid on top of the emotional letdown led to the team's decision to opt out? Would seniors with expiring eligibility and no NFL future have lobbied for one last chance to play for ND if they had more time to decide?
You know, the time frame didn't give them a lot of time to do it, and yet I think they came to a decision. I mean, Marcus Freeman, Pete Pavakwa, I'm not going to even finish the sentence here. I'm just going to jump around forever. So let me rephrase my answer here. Pete Pavakwa did a really good job of getting us a peek of how Marcus Freeman handled this. And he wanted to make sure that those guys were not making an emotional decision, that this was solely driven by emotions. And so he's like, let's think through all this. You know, we only have a couple hours, but we need to really think through having, I think that they would have come, if they had a day to think of it, they would have come to the same decision. And I think they're probably more resolute in it than they were before in terms of, yeah, this was the right thing to do. I think they're feeling pretty good about making this decision. I don't think there's buyer's remorse.
Yeah, it's certainly possible. Like my thought was like, well, maybe if there's more time for it, maybe the younger players feel more emboldened to say, hey, talk to the older players that maybe you're going to sit out, like, hey, let us go out there and play for you guys. We want to do this. We can go out there and represent you well. So maybe that something like that could have happened if they're given more time. But I think certainly the time frame influenced the decision. That doesn't necessarily mean that they wouldn't have come to the same decision if given more time. Go Irish on the Loose Emoji board said, could Jack, and I believe he means Sobel here, ask Marcus Freeman if he had had time to reflect on the players he used during garbage time, because that was a question Jack asked about in terms of using garbage time this season. How will it transition, or some other big word y'all use, to next year's team? Follow up, ask Pete Pavakwa what he intends to get Hunter Yurecek for Christmas.
I think Jack asks excellent questions and wears excellent shirts to the press conference. So I'm not going to bag on Jack, because I think he's awesome and I think he's a rising star in our business. How will it transition? Now, I'm the one that Tyler Orca and I are the ones that use the words that are probably
that throw Marcus
big.
Freeman off.
So we will say, how will it transition till next year's team? I mean, the one thing Notre Dame did a good job of, in all seriousness, was getting some playing time in November for players that they wanted to redshirt and yet get some developmental time. I thought they did a good job with that. Follow up, ask Pete what he intends to get Hunter Yurashek for Christmas. So I think it's pretty easy. He's going to get him a Gaslight.
The guys who played in games who I think could play roles next season, this is the list I came up with: running back Aeneas Williams, running back Nolan James Jr., tight end James Flanagan, offensive tackle Matty Augustine, offensive lineman Will Black, defensive tackle Cole Mullins, defensive end Logan Thomas, and safety Ethan Long. I think those are guys that played late in games throughout the season that could benefit the Irish next year. At Enforcers 21-17, do you think Joe Rudolph?
Okay. I'm sorry. I thought that was a different question, but maybe it's coming up.
It is asked in a different question, but that's how I, in terms of how it will transition to next year's team, I figured.
Okay. I'll answer it when it comes up in that question.
At Enforcers 21-17, do you think Joe Rudolph gets let go? Not being able to run the ball on short yardage situations all year seemed to be a problem.
No, he's actually in demand. He's not getting let go. If he leaves, it's because somebody else wants him.
Yeah, I don't think he's leaving, and I don't think he's getting fired. He's had terrible injury luck, and the offensive line has been better than fine. It has not maybe been able to maximize its potential. A motto that Marcus Freeman likes to live by. But I think Joe Rudolph has done a fine job as Notre Dame's offensive line coach. All right, here's the question that you were referencing at Mike DeVoy 1. Hi, Eric and Tyler. Excellent. Football never sleeps this week. Good observations with no whining. Who are the players who got limited reps this year that you think will have a breakout season next year? Who do you think wins the backup quarterback battle? Blake Hebert, Noah Grubbs, Teddy Girard, or TBD transfer? I know it's way early to choose one, but I still value your informed opinions.
Okay, I'm going to break this up into two, and I'll do the next year's guys. And there are potentially a lot of starters coming back, especially on the defensive side of the ball. If Anya got his sixth year, there could be as many as 10 starters coming back from the end of the year starting group. That wouldn't include Rubio, who was hurt earlier and didn't play the last month. So having said that, you know, what does a breakout year look like? These are the guys that I thought could surge. And some of this is dependent on what Notre Dame does in the portal, but I think Aeneas Williams and Nolan James Jr., I think Cam Williams and Micah Gilbert will get a look, but I think Notre Dame is shopping for a boundary receiver, which would affect them. I think Black and Augustine are going to be hard to keep off the field next year, especially if Emil Wagner and somebody else goes pro, if Emil and Shrout both go. James Flanagan is the guy I could see playing a lot more. Chris Burgess moving inside, depending on what Notre Dame does with those interior defensive line portal acquisitions. Chris Burgess is a guy they really feel like could take off if he embraces being an inside player. Dallas Golden could be a guy that's, although he played a lot this year, but Dallas Golden, if he's the starting nickel, could be really interesting. And then Ethan Long was my other guy that I threw in there.
Yeah, in terms of, like, I shared the list of guys earlier, but the guys that I feel the most strongly about would probably be Aeneas Williams, James Flanagan, and one of the two offensive linemen. I think it sort of just depends on
position.
Yeah, which position is the bigger need and how they fill that. So Matty Augustine or Will Black, I expect one of them to be able to find a role next season. All right. In terms of the quarterback as well, who do you think wins the backup quarterback battle?
Portal guy.
I would go with Grubbs right now. I think a lot of us like to second guess Noah Grubbs, but all he does is win football games. At Charles W. Wolf, since we've been relegated to the land of hypotheticals, do you think a healthy 2026 team could have closed the 11-point gap against Ohio State? Also, will Eric be using his Super Chat money to purchase bling so he can dress like football crush Tay Johnson?
So as far as the hypothetical with Ohio State, I mean, I don't know what Ohio State's roster is going to look like. I would assume it's going to be really, really good. But I do think the 2026 roster has the potential to be better than the 2024 and the 2025 in terms of balance, in terms of depth, and in terms of star power. So does that close the gap? I'm not sure because I don't know what Ohio State has, but I think it will make it really difficult to keep Notre Dame in the playoff next year. As far as super chat money to purchase the clothing that Tay Johnson has or the bling that he has, it's first of all, we don't get to keep that. So, but and for me, my drip game is not financially related, although it could be, but it's just not having very good taste. So I would need a fashion consultant. I need Jack Sobel to help me with my fashion choices.
Yeah, I had a tough time with this Ohio State hypothetical because we don't know what the 2026 Notre Dame team is going to look like yet. There's still so much to play out with that to be able to.
Well, Jack and I had to do projected depth charts for that team.
Right.
And I did mention in the lead, this is not just a way too early. It's a way, way, way too early.
But you have obviously this could all change, but like, yeah. So I don't know. Like I'd rather compare the 2025 team. Cause at least we know what that team is. I think it probably a healthy 2025 team could have given Ohio State a run for its money in last year's Ohio national championship game. So there's a chance that Notre Dame's 2026 team could be that good as well. All right, Marie Biafore, do either of you want to comment on the deal University of Utah made with private equity this week with regards to what it means for college football? As the first domino has now fallen, do you think we will be seeing a lot more of this?
In fairness to me, it's a little out of my wheelhouse right now. I have limited bandwidth, Marie, at my age. And so I focus really on what's going on with Notre Dame. But I am interested in these big picture things, and I have read a little bit. I think the concern, and I understand why this is important to you because you're a former Notre Dame tennis player. There's a concern that inviting private equity situation is going to mean de-emphasizing and squeezing the Olympic sports. I don't know that that's going to happen, but that's a fear of people that don't want to do it. Will it be a domino? I mean, the Big Ten has been looking at this for a while with resistance from Michigan and USC. It's a way to maximize, you know, your revenues. I mean, these colleges, look at the coaching salaries and the player salaries and so forth. You got to find revenue somewhere. So I think they're going to at least take a look at this. I just don't know how seriously Notre Dame would be looking at this right now.
Yeah, we have some experience in what private equity does to businesses based off of our newspaper careers. And everything that I've seen and witnessed both personally and from others across the country is that private equity often comes in and starts slashing as much as it can in terms of trying to get a better bottom line. I don't know what that means for college football and how that would be different. Like, I think you could make an argument that, well, college football is a much more healthy business than the newspaper business is, for instance. I'm sure, and obviously the newspaper business isn't the only business that private equity has played a role in, but that's the one that we're most familiar with. So I would be nervous to get private equity involved, and I think that's why some folks have pushed back on it, like you mentioned with the Big Ten. So I don't know enough about what the deal is, what protections University of Utah has. But whenever you get someone else investing in you, you have someone else to answer to as well. So that doesn't seem like a good thing in from my perspective. All right, a couple more questions here, Eric. I know we've got a marathon going on here, but at Mike Devoy one, do you think Michigan will try to hire Brian Kelly? Would Brian Kelly be interested?
These are really good questions today. I don't mind doing the marathon. So, Mike, do I think Michigan will try to hire Brian Kelly? No. Would BK be interested? Maybe, but I think he's going to sit out 2026 and kind of reassess what he wants to do.
Yeah, Michigan is certainly falling on hard times and is in a pickle. I'm not sure if the times are hard enough to hire a coach who just got fired this past season. That would probably be not be something that the Michigan fan base would be too excited about. Would Brian Kelly want to get into that mess? I don't know that he'd want to do that either. So it doesn't make a lot of sense to me from either perspective. But obviously, I understand why people are connecting the dots potentially there. And our last question is from Dave Hodges, big underscore D Hodges. Who's going to be our coach next year?
Well, I think it's going to be Marcus Freeman. It was interesting because Kyle Kelly, one of our colleagues, and I were talking yesterday, actually about recruiting, but he asked me a question at the end. He goes, I don't think Marcus Freeman's going anywhere. But if he was, who do you think would be first on Notre Dame's list? And I guess I'm so confident Marcus isn't. My mind doesn't go to that hypothetical. And so I really hadn't thought about it. And I started trying to think about it last night and I got a headache. But the first name that the first name that I came up with off the top of my head would be Clark Lea, just because he knows Notre Dame so well. Notre Dame was very impressed with him when he was at Notre Dame. Would he be the juggernaut recruiter that Marcus is? Probably not, but he is super talented in terms of evaluating players. And I think he would be smart enough to surround himself with people that were juggernaut recruiters. And look what he's done at Vanderbilt, which is a school that has similar high academic bar. What he's done there is amazing. And I know when I talked to him, I got smarter every time I talked to Clark Lea.
Yeah, I think it'll be Marcus Freeman as well. Unfortunately for Dave Hodges, who I believe has some Wabash ties, and I know that from the past. Unfortunately for him, it's not going to be Brett Dietz, who is DePauw's coach, who keeps beating Wabash on an annual basis. But appreciate the question, Dave, and hopefully Wabash gets back on the winning side of that for your sake. But I like the way the Monon Bell games have been going in recent years. All right, that is it for this week's episode of the Third and Gold podcast. You can find us on YouTube, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and other podcast homes. Search for Notre Dame Football with Eric Hansen and Tyler James if you're not already subscribed to the proper feeds. We have plenty of written content over at blueandgold.com to carry you into transfer portal season, so stick with Blue and Gold for all your Notre Dame coverage needs.